10. My own show. My star was rising. Like the bubbles in the glasses of champagne I would have been enjoying if I'd liked the taste of champagne, I was being recognized in hotel bars, train stations, W.H. Smith's, and the local branch of Do-It-All. It was a pleasantly warming sensation at first, before a stern lecture to self in my bathroom mirror, bought from Do-It-All, funnily enough, made me wise up. "These people don't care about you," I said. "You mean nothing to them. They'd sooner earn an extra £1,000 a year than worry about whether you're going to be the next presenter of Sports Night." And that realization that these people would stab me and spit on my jolting corpse probably did colour my approach to the general public. Don't get me wrong, I didn't become a recluse, but I steeled myself against hangers-on and well-wishers, typically meeting their so-called compliments with a snort or a stony silence. In the BBC, things were different. I worked on a style of glad-handing that I felt sure would ingratiate myself to more important people and earn me a reputation of being a charming TV personality. It had worked for Dale Winton, who could switch from air-kissing a commissioning editor to screaming hot spittle into the face of a researcher in about 3 seconds. But he was inhaling a lot of nail varnish remover around that time, I'm told. Back to me. I was becoming known for my no-nonsense interview style and my never-say-die attitude, certainly in my opinion, and I'm sure in the opinions of a many great others. Sometimes that meant being ruthless. A trait I demonstrated when grabbing the first interview with javeliner Steve Backley after quite a lovely throw at Crystal Palace. Seeing ITV's Jim Rosenthal jostling for position, I sidled up behind him, muttered, "Hello, Jim," and as he turned to respond, he fell, slash was pushed, off the media rostrum. He landed on a stack of hurdles, suffering cuts and bruises, as well as some pretty seriously duffed-up pride. Well, Gary Newbon went spastic. The two of them were the Tweedledum and Tweedledoo of ITV Sport. Great friends on and off camera, and our feud was real and long-standing. Newbon tore off his jacket, then his shirt, pounding at his belly and tits, shouting, "Come on, then! Come on!" It was incredibly unseemly, and I know Gary was kept away from athletic events for a good while after that. I secured the interview and asked Backley some searching questions about his training regime, skin-tight sportswear, and marital status. The piece went out that night. You could see Newbon in the background, facing away from camera, but slumped on a folding chair, by then in tears. But needless to say, I had the last laugh. I hated ITV back then, and that loathing spurred me on to be the man on the scene whenever a sports star or their attractive spouse had anything to say. I had an easy way with people, and, much like Piers Morgan today, was able to flit effortlessly from the highbrow to the utterly juvenile, from the serious to the inconsequential in a heartbeat. Unlike Morgan, I can also flit back the other way, whereas he is often stranded in thick alley for the remainder of the conversation. You can actually see his eyes swiveling as he struggles to break free of the tabloid moorings. Still, he's a good interviewer and a solid guy. But I was a bloody good interviewer and a bloody solid guy. I began to wonder if I was fulfilling my potential. My son was teaching me about quadratic equations at the time, and although I'd convinced him that they were genuinely irrelevant in real life, it convinced me that I should look for a fresh challenge. Like so. Alan asking sports questions equals bloody good sports interview, which means if you divide both by sport, you get Alan asking questions equals bloody good interview. It went something like that anyway. At a BBC party that autumn, I introduced myself to a commissioning editor by the name of Adam Walters. I remember the moment well. "You're Adam Walters, aren't you?" I said. "Yes," he replied. Walters was being talked of as the next big thing in BBC commissioning, something I found hard to understand, and still do, given the role of a commissioner is basically to put a tick or a cross on a box. Who knows? Maybe he had neat handwriting. Or maybe he had friends in high places. Either way, Adam was a good person to know, so I found out where he played squash and would make sure I happened to be having a shower and talc there at the same time as he/him. Quaffing a juice afterwards one day, I suggested that I come in and talk about the idea of a chat show in which I, the chat show host, would chat to guests on the show. He was intrigued at what was a really fresh idea, and an appointment was duly arranged for that afternoon. I ran home, excess talc spilling from the bottom of my trouser legs. I popped on my newest blazer, brushed my teeth, waited 6 hours, brushed them again, and called a cab. As I zoomed towards Shepherd's Bush, I opened the window, imagining my face on the billboards that massively spruce up Holland Park and then make Shepherd's Bush Roundabout a pleasure to circumnavigate. It would be called Alan's Show, I decided, and would be absolutely ace. I bounded into the foyer, announced that I was there to see Adam, and waited. And waited. The receptionist couldn't find any record of Mr. Walters. Are you sure he works for BBC TV? Then everything went quiet. Mouth dry, head spinning, and suddenly keen for a poo. I staggered from Television Centre, steadying myself on an old woman who was there for the BBC tour. I took another step into the street and bellowed at the sky. They want me back on the radio! You see, Walters was a radio commissioner. Of course. Of course. I should have known. He had that lifeless, grey, dead-eyed quality they all have at Broadcasting House. I called a cab and with a heavy heart went for a meeting with Adam Walters of Radio 4. It wasn't the best meeting I've ever had. Almost on autopilot, I ran through all the famous people I knew, who I said I could definitely get, and Walters seemed duly impressed. I was in a seriously bad mood, no doubt, but Adam's compliments and excellent selection of biscuits soon cheered me up. He all but offered me a show there and then. Pay dirt. People ask me if I found that daunting. They don't know Alan Partridge. If anything was making me apprehensive, it was that a light-hearted comment in which I joked that I owned my own production company and would make the show myself in exchange for a hefty development and production fee was somehow taken at face value. So the next morning I created a production company by putting posters up around Norwich and giving work experience to family friends, and Low Pear Tree Productions was born. Alan's Show, this was the working title, began production on the 9th of August 1992. Pear Tree Productions was a thrilling place to work, dynamic and young, indeed many of the staff should technically have been at school. But we really felt we were making something important, and so it proved. We worked out a format. I would ask questions, the guests would answer, as if in conversation, and after a few trial runs, I had it down pat. Unable to afford celebrity bookers, we relied on two researchers, Lisa and Jason, to approach agents, and on the whole they did a good job. Lisa's personality could be an issue. I suspected her of smoking cannabis and, as her employer, rifled through her bag to be sure. Nothing, but she went berserk. Her attitude really, really stank sometimes. The date of the first show approached, but we hit a snag. The BBC had decided that Alan's Show wouldn't work as a name. A team meeting was hastily called and we embarked on brainstorming, an American business technique in which ideas are graded depending on how loudly they're shouted. As the team screamed at each other, I noticed that my favourite CD, ABBA Gold, was on the stereo, and a song came on that I felt would be perfect. I sat and listened as the debate raged on among my colleagues, before shouting, "Shut up, you wallies, and listen to the music!" That got them. We sat in silence as the refrains of the song, "The Winner Takes It All," blasted from the office alba. It seemed so right, with its title reflecting my sporting heritage, while announcing myself as a triumph in the cutthroat world of broadcasting. As I sang along, eyes closed, I imagined it played to the applause of a studio audience. In the end, the group persuaded me that knowing me, knowing you was better, so we chose that one instead. Aha! What's that? What is aha? Well, it's a duosyllabic exclamation that has spilled from my chops and given pleasure to millions across the globe. Some would say it's come to define me. But how was it formed? I'll tell you the truth. We'd not even rehearsed it. I came out on stage for that first show sweating visibly and freely from my face, neck, pits, back and pants. "Knowing me, knowing you," sang the Jeff Lovell girls, and as the track reached its conclusion, they sang it again. My eyes filled with a burning white light and ABBA drenched my brain. Aha! I boomed. It just came out. Wallop! The audience didn't know what to say. Me? I took it in my stride, literally shaking at how right, how ruddy correct it had felt. Throughout that show, I said it a few more times, and I opened all subsequent shows with the same shout, and you know what? It became something of a calling card. Voted years later, 84th in Channel 4's 100 Best Catchphrases. And if people to this day shout it at me in the street, or when I'm trying to pay for my shopping, or if I ring up a call centre to renew car insurance, or in a doctor's waiting room, if I'm having trouble digesting food, it doesn't bother me. I'm fine with it. I actually like it. It makes me feel good and glad. Why wouldn't it? So if people think it does bother me, or that they're getting one over on me, or that it might be a good way of riling me, they could literally not be further from the truth. I do not give a fucking shit either way. No, if anything, I embraced it. In fact, the phrase has become so synonymous with Brand Partridge, I later took steps to claim some kind of entitlement to it, flying to Gothenburg to negotiate directly with Bjorn and Benjamin's lawyers for rights to shout but not say the word aha 50 times a year in perpetuity for the rest of my life or until 2015, whichever comes sooner. But that's by the by. The first show was a great success. Brain Box author Lawrence Camley was a ruddy good sport. Ali Tennant, a TV mind quack, was interesting, although perhaps too smutty for an audience reared on shipping news and dramas about farms. As with all feminists, she combined a hatred of being sexualized with a fixation that everything is to do with sex. I mean, do you like having it off or not? Hello? Afterwards, I went to congratulate Adam Walters, but he was tied up in a meeting, sitting still while the BBC Controller of Editorial Policy, John Wilson, paced and shouted incoherently. Every show thereafter was a great success. Don't read the reviews, said Martin Bell one day in the corridor. Don't have to, mate, I shouted back, a spring in my step. Each show seemed more informative, entertaining and superb than the last, although I felt the guests could have been better behaved. Controversial lawyer Nick Ford was an especially crass interviewee, not attempting to hide his homosexuality at all, as far as I could tell. We garnered pleasing column interest for what was a poorly marketed Radio 4 show, aided in no small part by the resignation of Government Minister Sandra Peakes in our third show. She'd been siphoning off government grants into her husband's construction firm and paying twin 17-year-old rent boys to engage in sexual acts. Although our conversation was somewhat fractious, Sandra and I remain very, very good friends, and I regret my line of questioning deeply. The so-called controversies were nobody's business but Sandra and Clive's. The show was being talked about not just in DIY stores or trumped-up newsagents, but in media circles. We enjoyed further publicity from the death, figuratively speaking, of comedian Bernie Rosen in week 5, and the death, actual, of Tory peer Lord Morgan of Glossop in our final show. But I don't think anyone was too upset. Lord Morgan's family began legal action and asking some searching questions about our indemnity insurance, but I don't think anyone seriously believed we'd been responsible. Can you imagine? Cause of death? Chat? I don't think so. No, far from being a downbeat end to the series, I was in high spirits. Our final show had seen a guest appearance from Tony Hayes, then acting commissioning director for BBC TV, and a man who frankly made Adam Walters look like a pathetic radio idiot. Tony and I hadn't met before, but knowing he was important, I kept an eye on him and admired him from afar, most notably in the BBC canteen from behind a newspaper. Walters had made it clear that Radio 4 wanted a second series. Join the fucking queue, mate, I said with my eyes. After the final show, with Tony heading for the car, I ran up behind him, shouting to be heard over the noise, as Lord Morgan's body was lifted into the ambulance. Tony, I said, are you going to put this baby on the goggle box or what? I was pleased he'd come to the last show of the series because, by this point, my new look was really taking shape. My clothes were, and would remain, somewhere in the sweet spot between smart and smart casual. But it was my hair that had taken the quantum leap forward. Chat show hosts normally kept things pretty trim up top. I, however, liked to think outside the square. So I'd grown it. It was now thick, full, and, if I tipped my head right back, shoulder length. See picture section, if in the book version. If the day was an even number, I'd wash it, and if it wasn't, I'd just shake it loose and brush through a little olive oil. It worked for me then, and I know it works for Jonathan Ross now, though he's replaced the olive oil with Frylight cooking spray. As this thought had been so long, I decided to repeat my question. Tony, I said, are you going to put this baby on the goggle box or what? We'll see, he said. Which at first I thought was a worryingly non-committal handoff, but then I thought about it, about his specific choice of words. See, he said, not hear. See. He was talking in visual terms. This, I felt sure, was him saying in code, your show will be seen on television. I punched the air, and whooped before lowering my voice out of respect for Lord Morgan's nearby relatives. The next day, I walked into Pear Tree Productions, doubled everyone's pay, then sacked Lisa.